Welcome to the Tuesday Brown Bagger, folks, where we offer you some of the best speeches of the city. Today is no exception. We've recorded Loretta Napoleoni, author of the new book, Rogue Economics, Capitalism's New Reality. Napoleoni's first nonfiction book, Terror, Inc., Tracing the Money Behind Global Terrorism, was translated into 12 languages. Now she's back with a stark warning that globalization has opened up new holes where laws do not exist and where entrepreneurs can take advantage of the world's most disadvantaged people. In just a minute, we'll bring you the full speech, Rogue Economics, recorded in Vancouver at Langara College on April 7th, 2008.
Well, thank you very much. It is a real pleasure to be back in Vancouver, even if the weather is never nice when I come, because I always come in the winter. So I hope somebody will invite me to give a speech in the summer. But anyway, so thank you also for organizing, to the Langara University, for organizing this talk. I must say, I like the title, Terrorist, Money, and You. So what I'm going to do today, I'm going to speak a little bit about terrorists, a lot about money, and extensively about you. So be ready for big revelations about your life as a citizen of the global village. So let me just start by telling you, how did I get the idea to write this book? Rogue Economics. Now, when I was doing the book promotion of Insurgent Iraq, which is about 2.5 years ago, I was traveling North America, and somebody said, oh, you must read this new book, Freakonomics, because it's really strange what he's talking about. So I bought the book, and I read the first chapter, and I thought, wow, this is really one little tiny part of what is happening at a global level. And I also understood why it was so successful, because he was giving some straightforward answer to very uncomfortable questions, which is, what is wrong with the life in the global village? Now, I had the same problem that everybody has, meaning I do enjoy the advantages of globalization, but I had in the back of my mind this sort of uncomfortable feeling about something is wrong about the world as it's taking shape at the moment, but I couldn't really pinpoint why. What was the real element that was bothering me about this globalized economy? So one day, my youngest son forced me to watch The Matrix, the film. I did not want to watch it. For years, I had refused it, because in my mind, there was the Matrix was one of those films about violence or electronic special effects. But he said, Mom, you got to watch it, because this is really good. And I watched The Matrix, and suddenly, I understood what was wrong. I mean, we do run the risk in this global economy to become just numbers inside the matrix, because, you know, nobody really hears our voice, but at the same time, we also have not the possibility to influence politics or economics, because we are in this enormous global environment. So I decided, after watching The Matrix, to research this topic. So the idea to write this book basically came at that time. And I thought, maybe if I analyze what really went wrong with Western capitalism in the globalization process, maybe I can rectify some of these feelings of feeling uncomfortable, basically. And my idea was, what is happening today, it's very much a unique phenomenon. So in my mind, there was that nothing as it is happening today had ever happened before. So I started my research, and because we live in a globalized world, I decided not to limit myself to economics, but, you know, to expand on other fields. So I look at culture, I look at music, and I had to ask my kids to help me to a certain extent. For example, I asked one of my kids who is really into rap music to explain to me what is rap music, which, believe me, was not easy for somebody with my curriculum. But anyway, I did it. And in the end, as I was progressing in this research, I realized that my original assumption was completely wrong. That would have made a fantastic PhD dissertation, actually. Because I realized that this is not, rogue economics is not a unique phenomenon. It's not something that is happening today. It has happened through the centuries. We have seen it during the Industrial Revolution. We've seen it after the fall of the Roman Empire, even after the crisis of 1929. At times of great transformations, economics moves much faster than politics. And politics loses control of economics. And it is in this particular situation that economics can become, and often does become, a rogue force. But in the long run, politics always regain control, because politics is us, the people. And so, after this process, after this traumatic process, we can enjoy progress. So the great leap forward of society have taken place at time of rogue economics. Now, look, for example, at the comforts of your everyday life. Many are related to the Industrial Revolution. Now, the Industrial Revolution was based upon the exploitation of the poor and the weak. And yet, it gave us the world we live in today. So this was, I must say, quite a shocking conclusion. But at the same time, it was a very positive conclusion. I never wanted to write a book against globalization. I never wanted to put the clock backwards. But I was quite anxious about what was going wrong. And then in the end, the conclusion of the book, that I can't tell you because otherwise you're not going to buy the book, of course, but are very positive. So let me explain now what is rogue. I mean, why did I choose a word like rogue? Now, rogue economics has nothing to do with rogue nation. I mean, lots of people will associate it with that concept. It is something completely different. It is a sort of umbrella under which you do find the criminal economy, you do find the illegal economy, and even the terror economy, but also grey areas. Grey areas created by this sudden transformation. Inside this grey area, we see the birth of rogue entrepreneurs. These are people who are not actually breaking any law, because there are no laws. But these are people who can reap the benefits of these sudden changes. So this is the concept of rogue, which is not necessarily a negative concept, so an illegal concept, but it's maybe an unethical concept. Now, in order to explain to you in a short time what the book is about, I will isolate three main aspects of rogue economic, and then I'll talk about these aspects. And then maybe during the question and answer we can expand about that. So the first element is this creation of these grey areas and the birth of rogue entrepreneurs. And these individuals, as they act inside these grey areas, they start creating new economic interdependencies. And these economic interdependencies are at times surreal, in that Freakonomics was very much spot on what is happening today. The other element is the transition of the nation state into a market state. This, again, is a phenomenon that is very much linked to the present transformation, so it is a phenomenon linked to globalization. And then the third element is the market matrix. The market matrix is a web of political, economic, and commercial illusions, which basically trap us. To a certain extent, the global village is a gigantic market matrix, and we are inside of it, and we don't know that we are there. So The best way to explain these gray areas and how these interdependencies are created is to tell you the story of the Russian oligarchs. What's happened with the fall of the Berlin Wall was that an entire section of the world, which was a section ruled by centrally planned economics, was all of a sudden moving in a transition towards a market economy. Now, there were serious difficulties in this transition. And one of these difficulties was how to transform an economy which is totally non-monetarized, where money really doesn't have any meaning, into a market economy. Now, inside the Soviet bloc, there were two types of currencies. There was the non-convertible ruble and the convertible ruble. Now, the non-convertible ruble was used by 70% of the economy. It was the currency that was used in trade, not only inside the various countries, but also between the various communist countries. And these non-convertible rubles were pieces of paper. So there were a sort of promissory notes that one government would issue saying, I will pay this amount of money. But of course, you know, they were not convertible. You couldn't go to a bank and convert them into real money. And this is because the communist economic system was basically a barter system. Now, the convertible rubles were money which were used inside the Soviet Union, and primarily they were used in the black market. So they had a value in terms also of foreign currency. But of course, you couldn't go outside the Soviet Union and exchange rubles. But you could inside the Soviet Union at the black market. Now, the black market was fundamental for an economy that was constantly plagued by shortages. So the government was, to a certain extent, even encouraging the growth of this black market because it kept social tension at bay. So people were perfectly happy to pay a lot of money to get the goods that they wanted in the black market. So this was the picture the day the Berlin Wall came down. So the real problem when the IMF moved into Moscow was how are we going to convert all these pieces of paper into real money? Now, the central bank couldn't do that because the central bank did not have enough cash in order to exchange non-convertible rubles into convertible rubles. Printing money would have been disastrous because that would have meant inflation. So they had to find a solution. Now, one key point here is that the institution of treasury in communist countries did not exist. So there was not an institution that could have actually taken over the task of progressively transform these pieces of paper into real money. So Gorbachev had an idea, and he had this idea during a discussion with the big economists of the IMF, including Joseph Stiglitz, for example. And he said, why don't we do this? Why don't we give the right to transform these non-convertible rubles into rubles to the communist youth club of the universities? Because this is ideal. They are everywhere. So, you know, they had a very large territorial structure. And we can basically give them this task. And this idea was accepted by the IMF as a great idea. So basically the youth clubs were allowed to transform this piece of paper into real money by organizing scientific social events. Now, the most popular scientific social events that they organized were pop concert and beauty contest. That was really very, very popular. So the majority of the oligarchs, the future oligarchs, they were the presidents of these youth clubs. Now, Khodorkovsky, the guy that eventually bought Yukos, one of the largest holding of natural gas and oil of Russia, he was the president of the Communist Youth Club of Moscow. Now, he basically set up many, many schemes in order to strip the assets of the nation, to basically steal, I would say, you know, the wealth of the nation. And I'll tell you just one, just to give you an idea of these gray areas. So Khodorkovsky would organize beauty contests and pop concerts. People would go, and they would pay with non-convertible ruble. It would take this non-convertible ruble and exchange it for foreign exchange with timber companies who exported timber from the former Soviet Union. It would take this cash, so our currency, and buy computers in the West, import the computers into Russia, sell them for non-convertible ruble, and start all over. This is how these guys became so rich. But they didn't break any law, because there was no law. On the contrary, they were given a certain task. Now, of course, the task was to help the state to monetize the economy. It was not to get rich by doing that. But this is what's happened. Now, at the same time, this story can give you an idea of the surreal interdependencies that are created in a situation where you have rogue economics. Now, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, women unemployment in the former Soviet Union went from virtually zero to 70 to 80%. I mean, all the economy collapsed, but particularly sector of the economy where women were employed. Now, people were desperate, and in order to feed their families, they resolved to prostitution. So they decided that that was the only way to support themselves. Now, one of the places where the Russian mafia started recruiting these women was at the beauty contests organized by the youth clubs. That was a very easy place to do the recruiting. A lot of these women, actually, were lured into prostitution with the promise to get great jobs in the West. And they ended up getting into the West and being forced into prostitution. Now, I, in the book, there are many stories that relate to this aspect of this, rogue interdependency. But I interviewed lots of people in West Berlin who made a fortune by running various sex clubs and prostitution rackets, and they all told me that there was an increase. Exponential increase in the supply of prostitutes right after the war came down and through the 1990s. It was all run by the mafia, the Russian mafia. So what this story can tell you is that we do have situations where the state is unable to predict what is going to happen. And to a certain extent, the state retreats from a position in which, you know, you should really look after the individual, you should look after society. And within this situation, you can have surreal interdependencies. Now, Khodorkovsky had nothing to do with the Russian mafia. He was not really interested in that kind of business, but he created the ideal condition for the Russian mafia to transform women into a merchandise that then was sold into the global sex market. Because, you know, from Western Europe, these women were then exported everywhere else. So, the fall of the Berlin Wall, it is the beginning of this process of globalization. Why it is the beginning? Because even if before, through the 1980s, we had a process of privatization carried out by Reagan, Mrs. Thatcher, whereby, you know, Western capitalism was moving away from industrialized countries into developing countries, the world where they could expand was actually much smaller. The moment in which the wall came down, Western capitalism could expand worldwide, and to a certain extent, the entire planet Earth became Western capitalist oyster. So this is why I started this research from that particular event. Now, as the wall came down, we saw the spreading of democracy, because that was, in the end, the final goal of knocking down the Iron Curtain, was to give the possibility to communist countries to become democratic countries, as, you know, we are. And as you see democracy is spreading. So we see democracy, the number of democratic countries move from 63 before 1989 to 118 in the early 1990s. You also see the spreading, the increase of slavery. Now, there is a perfect correlation between democracy and slavery. Now, that is quite shocking. I mean, the ILO, the International Labour Organization, has actually produced data about this. And the number of slaves at the end of the 1990s, when, you know, this spreading of democracy reached to a certain extent, you know, its peak, was 27 million. And when I talk about slave, I do not talk about slave labor. I talk about real slavery, where people are deprived of their freedom. They are owned by other individuals, and they are forced into doing things that they don't want to do. Now, the story that I told you about Russian prostitute, it is very much related to that. We also saw, with the fall of the Berlin Wall, an increase in sex slave coming from this country, from former Soviet, from the former Soviet bloc. So, so basically, this is the picture that emerge from these gray areas created by rogue economics. Now, the second element, it is the transition from the nation state to the market state. Now, all of this is happening while the state is changing its role. Now, the nation state is very much a creation of 17th, 18th century. This is a state whereby the individual decides to renounce certain kind of liberty in exchange for the state to protect him, so to give him the protection necessary for having a good life. This state disappears through this process of globalization, because we see a new form of state, which is the market state. Now, this is not a concept which I developed. This is a concept developed by Philip Bobbitt in his book, The Shield of Achilles. What Philip Bobbitt described is a state which is becoming more and more a sort of institution which provides the best economic condition for the individual or the corporation in order to become rich. So that's the definition of this state. Now, this is a state that in economy want to deregulate, wants to carry out a sort of deregularization policy. So bring down all the barriers, reduce state intervention at the maximum. And this is very much what we have seen through the process of globalization. Globalization took place because barriers came down, because of deregulation. And the first consequences of this new vision, of this new interdependency between the state and the economy, is actually the increase in the supply of labor. Now, as communism was dismantled, we saw an influx of labor moving from the former communist countries into the West. But then we also saw an influx of labor coming from the Asian countries. And statistics show that the supply of labor from the late 80s to the mid-90s doubled. Now, that produced a decline trend in salaries. Because, of course, when, you know, labor is largely available, salaries start to go down. And then we see other phenomena like offshoring, outsourcing. So overall, the return on capital start rising. And on top of that, of course, we had a declining interest rate. So a new wealth, a real new wealth, was created through the 1990s because of deregulation, but also because of globalization. Now, when you go and analyze where did this new wealth actually went, that's another shocking rogue economics discovery. Now, the majority of this new wealth ended up being earned by a very small number of the population. We're talking about 1% or even less than 1%. Now, what happened during the 90s and continues to happen today, especially in the United States and in some European countries like the United Kingdom, is income inequality. So the difference between the middle class and the rich, for example, has increased tremendously to the extent that today the median income of middle America, so the income which is sandwiched between the rich and the poor in the United States, is actually in real terms, so net of inflation, lower than it was in the late 60s, early 70s. We have gone backwards, basically. Now, this is also something that happens within this single corporation and companies. So if you look at Wall Street, the companies that operate on Wall Street, the CEO of these companies is actually taking the majority of the increase in earning of the companies. And the difference in salary between middle management and the CEO has actually increased tremendously through the 90s and through the 2000.
You are listening to Loretta Napoleoni talking about her new book, Rogue Economics, Capitalism's New Reality, published by Seven Stories Books.
Now, to show you visually what I'm describing, a Dutch statistician produced the Income Parade. Now, the Income Parade is a parade where people march according to their height, and their height is the equivalent of their income. So the taller is the richer and the shorter is the poorer. So the income parade starts and you see people below the poverty line marching, and they are below 1 meter tall. And they march for hours. Then you get, you know, the poor, and they march for hours. Then you get the middle class, which is probably tall, 1 meter 70. And they also march for hours. Then suddenly you see people jumping. So from 1 meter 70, you see people that are 300 meters, 400 meters, 3 kilometers tall. These are the super rich. And what is interesting also is that when you look at the composition of this tiny percentage of the population, so that 0.1% of the population, the very, very rich, you see a lot of people who have accumulated immense wealth because of globalization. And among these people, you find great sportsmen like Tiger Woods, for example, actors like Tom Cruise, but also CEOs of the big hedge funds of Wall Street. Now, these people are earning a massive amount of money in comparison to people who are in the same industry. So that goes from the guy who cuts the grass in the golf course where Tiger Woods is going to play, to the manager of the cinema where in the film of Tom Cruise is going to be shown. And the difference between this individual is that the manager of the cinema cannot get the benefits of globalization, while Tom Cruise, of course, can. His film can be seen everywhere. Now, this is another, I think, very interesting phenomenon, another, I would say, you know, novelties of, you know, globalization. Now, finally, the interesting interdependency, which we're living today, not in Canada, not yet, but in the United States, it is the role of this market state, this withdrawal of the state from the field of economics, and the weird, really negative consequences of letting the economy run by itself. And this is the crisis of the subprime, the mortgage crisis. What has happened in the United States is the transformation of what was a growing debt into a growing asset. And this took place under the eyes of a state which was not interested in this transformation, which was not really interested in the consequences of this transformation. And how did it happen? Well, it happened because, again, through these great changes due to the globalization of the economy, a group of companies, a group of individuals were able to create great opportunities for them. And by doing that, they basically turn America into a country which is in debt and is not growing anymore. I'll just very briefly explain how they did it. So mortgages were given to people, aggressively actually marketed to people, because interest rates were coming down. Interest rates have been coming down since the fall of the wall. This was the policy of the Fed to pursue a sort of cheap credit kind of policy in order to resolve any kind of globalization crisis. So each time there was a problem, like the peso crisis, for example, the Asian market crisis, interest rates were cut. But cutting interest rate meant that selling these mortgages could be very profitable for banks. And then all of a sudden banks thought, well, you know, we can transform these mortgages into stocks because these mortgages are worth a lot of money as prices of property was rising. Each time prices of property was rising, the mortgage that a bank held was actually increasing in value. So they repackaged using derivatives. Now, derivatives are a new phenomenon created in the early 1990s, totally, totally non-regulated. There was no single legislation that refers to derivatives. In fact, most people don't even know what they are because they are created as, you know, as people go along, especially in finance. So these mortgage-backed securities were repackaged into stocks, and these stocks were sold over and over and over, you know, all over the world. When America started to be unable to pay back the mortgages, then, you know, these house of cards created by finance started to crash. And you could have seen this happening already 2 years ago. Now, in 2002, the rate of bankruptcy, difficult word for me, in America was higher than the rate of growth of the GDP. Now, how is it possible that the politicians, even the Fed, did not realize that something was going wrong? I mean, the country was borrowing more and it was unable to pay at a rate higher than the rate of growth. And yet, nothing happened until last August when, you know, the first bankruptcy of banks started to take place. And now every day we open the newspaper and we read stories about that. And now we have the Fed pumping $30 billion into the economy on a weekly basis in order to prevent a major crash. So that's, I think, is a very topical story of, you know, rogue economics. And all of this, of course, took place while the consumer didn't know really what was happening. People were offered mortgages, people were offered credit cards at ridiculously convenient rates, and, you know, they took it. Because, you know, they didn't really know what was going on. They didn't know what there was behind all of this cheap credit. And the reason why they didn't know is because they live in this web of illusions. And this is the market matrix. Now, the web of illusion, it is not only related to consumer products, it's not only related to economics, but it's also related to politics. And one of the biggest illusions of the last few years is actually the threat of terrorism. Now, we have been led to believe that terrorism has never been such a serious threat as it is today. In reality, it's exactly the contrary. Now, if you look at the statistics of the number of people that were killed by terrorists from the 1950s to today, decades after decades, the number of planes that were hijacked, you will be shocked to discover that the year 2000, it is the safest time in history in the West, in the West I'm talking about, from terrorism. Where terrorism is really flourishing is in the East. So in Muslim countries, places like Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, the Horn of Africa, this is where terrorism is really, really booming. But not in the West. We've never been as safe as we are today. And this is not because when you go to the airport, you have to carry a 20 by 20 centimeters plastic bag where you can put, you know, all your toiletries. It's not because of that. It's because the modern terrorists, the jihadists, the follower of Osama bin Laden, are actually a bunch of incompetent individuals. I can tell you lots of stories. I'll tell you just one, which I think is one of the best. So there was a group of these jihadists that wanted to bomb the American embassy in Rabat, in Morocco, and they got lost in the Medina and they couldn't actually reach destination. Now imagine the IRA in the 1970s. They get lost in the subway in London and can't put the bomb. That's the equivalent. So this is one of the big illusions, but this is a very powerful illusion because he has created this politics of fear, and on the basis of that, politicians have been able to do whatever they wanted. Have also been able not to tell the truth to parliament, not to tell the truth to voters, under this umbrella of secrecy. Well, in reality, this is all a gigantic illusion. So that's the politics. And then, of course, there is the commercial illusion, and I'll tell you very briefly the story of the fish pirates. So 70% of the fish that you eat is actually what the United Nations describe as black fish. This is fish that either is poached or is fish in territorial waters of other countries, or is actually fished by the pirates. There is an increase in piracy in the world since the end of the Cold War, which is frightening. Several organizations which deal with that, they are really desperate because they don't know how to contain it. Nobody patrols the seas. And what is happening in the ISIS is constant theft. This is really where rogue economics is blossoming. And the fish story is extremely interesting because you find situation whereby, for example, in the North Sea, the Norwegian are trying desperately to convince the British to check all the fish that arise into their ports because the pirates are fishing into the territorial water of Norway. They're depleting the resources of, you know, the sea, and the British are basically ignoring what the Norwegian are saying because they're not interested in that kind of business. Or we could say, you know, there are better fishes to fry, such as terrorists, for example. But the truth is that this is another aspect of globalization, is the fact that while, you know, crime has globalized, law enforcement has not globalized. And this is a key issue. How politics can actually control again economics if economics is global, if, you know, rogue economics is global and politics is not global. And another scary story, again, about the market matrix is what is happening in the gold market. Now, you don't know, but some of the gold earrings or your wedding ring can actually have been produced by children enslaved by the warlords of Congo, working in the mines of Ituri, where there is one of the largest production of gold in the world. Now, Congo cannot export gold because Congo is under the United Nations sanction because of the situation inside the country, i.e. the civil war. But what is happening is that Congo is exporting its gold via Uganda. So the gold is smuggled to Uganda. This particular business started in the early 1990s when the Ugandan trade system was liberalized, so everything can be exported. Now there is not anymore any type of control. Now, before that, Uganda did not export any gold, and yet people regularly buy gold from Uganda as if it's produced in Uganda. Now, the recent increase in the gold prices has produced several distortion, and one in particular, the United Nations in January warned the gold industry that if prices continue to rise, the black market will be booming. And this is because gold reached in January $950 an ounce. So at that point, the demand for gold for jewelries stopped. Because, you know, just at that level, nobody bought gold anymore. So all the demand was speculative demand. So speculators were just, you know, making money on the gold market. At that point, the United Nations noticed that the demand on the black market has started to skyrocket. And this is because, of course, on the black market, gold prices are not moved as quickly as the official market. And also they detected an increase in the smuggling from Congo. So this is also something, how these interdependencies can affect our life, but also the life of individuals who are the real victims of this rogue economics. Somebody speculates in Chicago on gold, push the gold prices up, and then, you know, it's making more money for the warlords of Ituri, and we end up buying a ring or, you know, an earring which is produced by these people. And this is the darkest side of rogue economics. It is our partnership with the slave traders, the fish pirates, the warlords of Congo, as consumers. Now, we are the unwilling partners of these individuals. We don't know. We open the refrigerator, and our refrigerator is full of products that were produced by slaves, for example. We don't know. But that doesn't mean that we do not have a responsibility in order to understand, to really become conscious of the world we live in. And only when we do, and I'm referring particularly to Western people in the West, only when we do, then we can do something. Because without knowledge, this rogue economics will never go away, will never reach the final stage, which is the positive stage, where, you know, then the economy will go back into where it should be under politics, and we can enjoy the benefits of globalization. So this is basically what I wanted to do with this book, was share my knowledge with everybody. I discovered this, and I think, you know, for me, at least, it was a great discovery. So I wanted to share with everybody else. And then from that, of course, each of us will have to find its own way forward. But if we don't know, then we'll be trapped inside this matrix forever. Now, this is quite a gloomy speech, but before I conclude, I want to tell you that there are positive things about rogue economics. I mean, rogue economics is reshaping the world, and in doing that, it's also created great opportunity for parts of the world, sectors also, that until now, they couldn't really take any advantages of globalization. And I just want to mention two. One is the fact that for the first time, because of what is happening in the soft commodities market, so we had 75% increase in prices of products and soft commodities related to food items in the last 12 months. So that goes from wheat, grain, and all the rice, for example, corn. Because of that increase, for the first time, African growers will be allowed to sell their products in the West without having to deal with the high tariff, which have protected our agriculture until today. Now, that is a rogue interdependency, which is positive. Because, you know, for the first time, these people will have a true opportunity, will not be given money, which will end up in the pockets of corrupted politicians. I mean, the actual growers will be able to have an economic opportunity. And the other aspect, which I think is positive, is the fact that we have a new sector of finance, which is Islamic finance. This is a sector which has been growing very, very fast. It is actually the sector of international finance that is growing the most, partly because, of course, it is directed to Muslims, and Muslims are 1.3 billion people. So the potential of growth for this sector are enormous. But this is also a sector of international finance which is completely shielded by the crisis of the subprime, because for Islamic finance, it is prohibited to invest in products which are linked to the interest rate. Islamic finance does not allow interest rate. Money cannot produce money. Money have to be invested in the real economy, and through growth, then they can generate profits. I mean, monetary profits. Yeah, so you should get an Islamic mortgage. This is what Islamic finance is all about. It is based upon the Sharia, but you know, you don't, if you're a woman, you don't have to wear a veil in order to go and get a mortgage. I mean, they'll give it to you. So this is very positive, because if this house of cards of the subprime will collapse, we will not face a 1929. We will go through a depression for sure, but it will not be a crisis like 1929, because there will be a sector of international finance which will continue to operate. And it doesn't matter if this sector of finance is located in other countries. I mean, in the United States and in Canada, there are not Islamic banks which are, you know, mainstream banks, I mean, operating retailing. But for example, in Great Britain, there are. So even in the West, there is this kind of system in place. So that's another positive element of rogue economics. So to conclude, we are living in very hard times, but things will get better. So that's the positive message in the end. Thank you.
That was Loretta Napoleoni talking about her new book, Rogue Economics, Capitalism's New Reality, published by Seven Stories Books. Ms. Napoleoni's visit to Vancouver was arranged by Langara College as part of their continuing public discussion series. This speech was recorded April 7, 2008, by Alex Smith for the Tuesday Brown Bagger Lunchtime Speech Series on CFRO, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. The lively question and answer period ran for over an hour. We have time to squeeze in some of the best of them, and we'll do that here. You can download the whole thing from a new website for the Brown Bagger radio program. It's at www.ecoshock.net/brownbagger.
So, please do not be shy. There are microphones. I'm going to take advantage of having a microphone. I'm going to ask the first question.
All right.
Signora, through the eye of rogue economics, how would you describe the position or the role of a company like Halliburton, which supplies peanut butter, buttons, tires, oil, people, cardboard, and so on, to what some of us would call a rogue war, and supplies it at an immense profit? And it just happens that the vice president of the nation in which Halliburton has its home has been on the board of directors of that organization for some time. How would you describe that peculiar relationship? Is that a new thing, or is that very much fitting with your description of rogue economics?
Yeah, I mean, that is one of the examples of rogue economics, because we see the state, which is turned into a market state. So you have the vice president who is clearly brokering on behalf of a company where he worked before, where he's still, part very much of the, I would say, the structure of the company, because he's still a shareholder. And this is also done openly, which is the other shocking thing. because it is accepted to a certain extent. This is also an aspect which I discuss in the book, is how then rogue economics does change morality, does change the perception of what is right and what is wrong. This is why I didn't limit the research only to economics. If you think something like this happening in the 1970s, it would be inconceivable. Absolutely inconceivable. I mean, you would have in a newspaper. I mean, think about, Watergate, for example. Something like Watergate would not happen today. Because the state has become a market state, to a certain extent, we are accepting this reality. Now, Halliburton happens to be one of the best examples because it is making money in an illegal war. It is actually making money in a war that was created through these illusions, through these lies. We were, sold a pack of lies about why we should go to Iraq. And yet, Halliburton hasn't broken any law, because there is no law. There is not a legislation. Now, there is a code of honor which doesn't exist anymore. And that's the same thing that is happening in finance. I mean, there were the so-called rule of the games which people followed. Because, of course, people in finance could have ripped off other people, the public, let's say, people, depositors, people that put their money, their saving into banks, even in the past. But there was a code of honor. Now, that code of honor doesn't exist anymore.
All right. I have lots of questions, but so do you. So let's start with this gentleman, please.
I'm wondering if you've noticed the new gray area that's opening up in carbon trading. We've seen an example in China recently where companies simply, by not opening up polluting facilities, ripped off about $6 billion through the Clean Development Mechanism. And we can expect more wild trading to come from Wall Street in carbon trading. Have you looked into that at all?
Yeah, I mean, China is one of the best example of rogue economics. It is also a country that is benefiting tremendously from rogue economics. But the thing is, what you said about Wall Street is very true. I mean, Wall Street, and for Wall Street, I refer to all the stock exchanges. Really, they don't care how the money are made. The important thing is that this money are made. And I'll tell you another interesting example. It is the tobacco industry. Now, the tobacco industry, it is the industry that is generating more profit than any other industry in the world, including the oil industry. And, of course, we don't know this. I mean, we are under this illusion that because people don't smoke anymore in the West because of the anti-smoking campaign, these guys are making no money. Well, this is very, very wrong, because since the fall of that wall, the tobacco industry has looked eastward. I mean, has looked at Russia. I mean, the cigarettes that mostly smoke in Russia are Winston. Philip Morris is generating billions and billions selling cigarettes to 500 million smokers in China. I mean, these are enormous figures. And what the tobacco industry, in particular Philip Morris, has done in the late 90s was to start investing these huge profits in the food industry. So a lot of products that we buy at the supermarket are actually owned by Philip Morris. And one of these big company was Kraft. Now, in January, Philip Morris decided to sell Kraft, and the share prices of Philip Morris, which is now Altria, that's the holding, went up 10%, because Wall Street wants a company that is 100% tobacco, because tobacco shares are the best performing shares of the last 30 years. When Wall Street collapsed in January, the only shares that kept rising were the share of the tobacco. So it's extraordinary. And do we know that? No. We think, nobody smokes anymore, nobody dies of cancer because of smoking. And then we go to the supermarket, we buy product of the tobacco industry, and we let them continue doing what they were doing in the West, in developing countries, and we don't care. I must say, I want to add something before you do. I mean, the biofuel business, for example, I mean, if you look into the biofuel, it actually consumes more energy than it's saving, number one. Now, it so happened that the biofuel is produced by people in the Midwest who are producing corn. And who are those people? This is the heartland of Bush electorate. Yeah. Let's not forget that. So we read in the newspaper, oh my gosh, you know, this is great, you know, 40% last year, I mean this year, 40% of corn has been diverted to produce biofuels. And we think, oh my gosh, you know, Bush is now finally seeing the light. And no, it's not like that at all. Bush has found yet another gimmick to make us think that things are on the right track, when in reality it's still doing something that's bad for the planet and is good for his electorate, which is a selected electorate.
So I was wondering, that do you see any commonalities between your analysis and Naomi Klein's analysis about the same issue?
The shock economy is not something that Naomi Klein invented. Adam Smith described the shock economy. Anybody that has a degree in economics has studied the shock economy. It is a phenomenon that especially classical economists have analyzed. So what she did, she basically applied this concept, which is a very well-known concept in economics, to a global economy. Personally, I think she gives too much credit to these guys that rule our world. I mean, I don't believe that they actually had the kind of intellectual capability to create a shock economy in order to benefit the economy of the leading countries, or, you know, mainstream capitalism. And this is the problem with most of this conspiracy theory or so-called left-wing theories. They overrate very much the people that are ruling us. I mean, I have worked with several governments, and I have met several of these politicians, and I can tell you that they are not at that level at all. It is great to sell books, to say that the neocons, because that's, you know, the message that she put in the book, that the neocons created this shock economy worldwide in order to make sure that Halliburton was profiting from the war in Iraq. But the truth is that these guys went into Iraq thinking that in 2 months they would win the war, and that, you know, it was going to be like Liberation Day in Rome or Paris. That's the degree of stupidity of these individuals. So, I mean, I don't believe that. I do think that rogue economics is something that happens at times, where, you know, politics just can't control the economy, and has nothing to do with conspiracy.
That was Loretta Napoleoni talking about her new book, Rogue Economics, Capitalism's New Reality, published by Seven Stories Books. Ms. Napoleoni's visit to Vancouver was arranged by Langara College as part of their continuing public discussion series. This speech was recorded April 7, 2008, by Alex Smith for the Tuesday Brown Bagger Lunchtime Speech Series on CFRO, Co-op Radio in Vancouver.